It might have been empty for years, that bed. Roland was alone now. God's help him, he was the last patient of the Little Sisters of Eluria, those sweet and patient hospitalers. The last human being still alive in this terrible place, the last with warm blood flowing in his veins. Roland, lying suspended, gripped the gold medallion in his fist and looked across the aisle at the long row of empty beds. After a little while, he brought one of the reeds out from beneath his pillow and nibbled at it. When Mary came 15 minutes later, the gunslinger took the bowl she brought with a show of weakness he didn't really feel. Porridge instead of soup this time, but he had no doubt the basic ingredient was still the same.
"How well ye look this morning, Si," Big Sister said.
She looked well herself. There were no shimmers to give away the ancient wampir hiding inside her. She had supped well, and her meal had firmed her up. Roland's stomach rolled over at the thought.
"Ye'll be on your pins in no time, I'll warrant."
"That's shit," Roland said, speaking in an ill-natured growl. "Put me on my pins and you'd be picking me up off the floor directly after. I've started to wonder if you're not putting something in the food." She laughed merrily at that.
"La, you lads! Always eager to blame your weakness on a scheming woman. How scared of us ye are. Aye, way down in your little boys' hearts, how scared ye are."
"Where's my brother? I dreamed there was a commotion about him in the night, and now I see his bed's empty." Her smile narrowed. Her eyes glittered.
"He came over fevery and pitched a fit. We've taken him to Thoughtful House, which has been home to contagion more than once in its time."
"To the grave is where you've taken him," Roland thought. "Mayhap that is a thoughtful house, but little would you know it, Si, one way or another."
"I know ye're no brother to that boy," Mary said, watching him eat.
Already Roland could feel the stuff hidden in the porridge draining his strength once more.
"Sigil or no sigil, I know ye're no brother to him. Why do you lie? 'Tis a sin against God."
"What gives you such an idea, Si?" Roland asked, curious to see if she would mention the guns.
"Big Sister knows what she knows. Why not fess up, Jimmy? Confession's good for the soul, they say."
"Send me Jenna to pass the time, and perhaps I'd tell you much," Roland said. The narrow bone of smile on Sister Mary's face disappeared like chalk writing in a rainstorm.
"Why would ye talk to such as her?"
"She's passing fair," Roland said. "Unlike some." Her lips pulled back from her overlarge teeth.
"Ye'll see her no more, Cully. Ye've stirred her up, so you have, and I won't have that."
She turned to go, still trying to appear weak and hoping he would not overdo it. Acting was never his forte. Roland held out the empty porridge bowl. "Do you not want to take this?"
"Put it on your head and wear it as a nightcap for all of me. Or stick it in your ass. You'll talk before I'm done with ye, Cully. Talk till I bid you shut up and then beg to talk some more."
On this note she swept regally away, hands lifting the front of her skirt off the floor. Roland had heard that such as she couldn't go about in daylight, and that part of the old tales was surely a lie. Yet another part was almost true, it seemed. A fuzzy, amorphous shape kept pace with her, running along the row of empty beds to her right. But she cast no real shadow at all. 6. Jenna, Sister Coquina, Tamra, Michella, Louise, the cross dog, what happened in the sage. That was one of the longest days of Roland's life. He dozed, but never deeply. The reeds were doing their work, and he had begun to believe that he might, with Jenna's help, actually get out of here. And there was the matter of his guns as well. Perhaps she might be able to help there, too. He passed the slow hours thinking of old times, of Gilead and his friends, of the riddling he had almost won at one wide earth fair. In the end another had taken the goose, but he had had his chance, aye. He thought of his mother and father. He thought of Abel Vanay, who had limped his way through a life of gentle goodness, and Eldred Jonas, who had limped his way through a life of evil, until Roland had blown him loose of his saddle one fine desert day. He thought, as always, of Susan.
"If you love me, then love me," she'd said.
And so he had. So he had. In this way the time passed. At rough hourly intervals he took one of the reeds from beneath his pillow and nibbled it. Now his muscles didn't tremble so badly as the stuff passed into his system, nor his heart pound so fiercely. The medicine in the reeds no longer had to battle the sister's medicine so fiercely, Roland thought. The reeds were winning. The diffused brightness of the sun moved across the white silk ceiling of the ward, and at last the dimness which always seemed to hover at bed level began to rise. The long room's western wall bloomed with the rose melting to orange shades of sunset. It was Sister Tamra who brought him his dinner that night, soup and another popkin. She also laid a desert lily beside his hand. She smiled as she did it. Her cheeks were bright with color. All of them were bright with color today, like leeches that had gorged until they were full almost to bursting.
"From your admirer, Jimmy," she said. "She's so sweet on ye. The lily means do not forget my promise. What has she promised ye, Jimmy, brother of Johnny?"
"That she'd see me again and we'd talk." Tamra laughed so hard that the bells lining her forehead jingled. She clasped her hands together in a perfect ecstasy of glee.
"Sweet as honey, oh yes."
She bent her smiling gaze on Roland.
"It's sad such a promise can never be kept. Ye'll never see her again, pretty man."
She took the bowl.
"Big sister has decided."
She stood up, still smiling.
"Why not take that ugly gold sigil off?"
"I think not."
"Your brother took his off, look."
She pointed, and Roland spied the gold medallion lying far down the aisle, where it had landed when Ralph threw it. Sister Tamra looked at him, still smiling.
"He decided it was part of what was making him sick and cast it away. Ye'd do the same, were ye wise?"
Roland repeated, "I think not."
"So,"
she said dismissively, and left him alone with the empty beds glimmering in the thickening shadows. Roland hung on in spite of growing sleepiness until the hot colors bleeding across the infirmary's western wall had cooled to ashes. Then he nibbled one of the reeds and felt strength, real strength, not a jittery, heart-thudding substitute, bloom into his body. He looked toward where the castaway medallion gleamed in the last light and made a silent promise to John Norman. He would take it with the other one to Norman's kin if Ka chanced that he should encounter them in his travels. Feeling completely easy in his mind for the first time that day, the gunslinger dozed. When he awoke, it was full dark. The doctor bugs were singing with extraordinary shrillness. He had taken one of the reeds out from under the pillow and had begun to nibble on it when a cold voice said,
"So, Big Sister was right. Ye've been keeping secrets."
Roland's heart seemed to stop dead in his chest. He looked around and saw Sister Coquina getting to her feet. She had crept in while he was dozing and hidden under the bed on his right side to watch him.
"Where did ye get that?" she asked. "Was it—"
"He got it from me."
Coquina whirled about. Jenna was walking down the aisle toward them. Her habit was gone. She still wore her wimple with its forehead fringe of bells, but its hem rested on the shoulders of a simple checkered shirt. Below this she wore jeans and scuffed desert boots. She had something in her hands. It was too dark for Roland to be sure, but he thought...
"You," Sister Coquina whispered with infinite hate. "When I tell Big Sister..."
"You'll tell no one anything," Roland said. If he had planned his escape from the slings that entangled him, he no doubt would have made a bad business of it. But as always, the gunslinger did best when he thought least. His arms were free in a moment, so was his left leg. His right caught at the ankle, however, twisting, hanging him up with his shoulders on the bed and his leg in the air. Coquina turned on him, hissing like a cat, her lips pulled back from teeth that were needle-sharp. She rushed at him, her fingers splayed, the nails at the ends of them looked sharp and ragged. Roland clasped the medallion and shoved it out toward her. She recoiled from it, still hissing, and whirled back to Sister Jenna in a flare of white skirt.
"I'll do for ye, ye interfering troll," she cried in a low, harsh voice.
Roland struggled to free his leg and couldn't. It was firmly caught, the shitting sling actually wrapped around the ankle somehow, like a noose. Jenna raised her hands, and he saw he had been right. It was his revolvers she had brought, holstered and hanging from the two old gun belts he had worn out of Gilead after the last burning.
"Shoot her, Jenna, shoot her!"
Instead, still holding the holstered guns up, Jenna shook her head as she had on the day when Roland had persuaded her to push back her wimple so he could see her hair. The bells rang with a sharpness that seemed to go into the gunslinger's head like a spike. The dark bells, the sigil of their quartet. What? The sound of the doctor bugs rose to a shrill, reedy scream that was eerily like the sound of the bells Jenna wore. Nothing sweet about them now. Sister Coquina's hands faltered on their way to Jenna's throat. Jenna herself had not so much as flinched or blinked her eyes.
"No," Coquina whispered. "You can't."
"I have," Jenna said.
And Roland saw the bugs. Descending from the legs of the bearded man, he'd observed a battalion. What he saw coming from the shadows now was an army to end all armies. Had they been men instead of insects, there might have been more than all the men who had ever carried arms in the long and bloody history of Midworld. Yet the sight of them advancing down the boards of the aisle was not what Roland would always remember, nor what would haunt his dreams for a year or more. It was the way they coated the beds. These were turning black two by two on both sides of the aisle, like pairs of dim rectangular lights going out. Coquina shrieked and began to shake her own head, to ring her own bells. The sound they made was thin and pointless compared with the sharp ringing of the dark bells. Still the bugs marched on, darkening the floor, blacking out the beds. Jenna darted past the shrieking Sister Coquina, dropped Roland's guns beside him, then yanked the twisted sling straight with one hard pull. Roland slid his leg free.
"Come," she said. "I've started them, but staying them could be a different thing."
Now Sister Coquina's shrieks were not of horror, but of pain. The bugs had found her.
"Don't look," Jenna said, helping Roland to his feet. He thought that never in his life had he been so glad to be upon them. "Come, we must be quick. She'll rouse the others. I've put your boots and clothes aside up the path that leads away from here. I carried as much as I could. How are ye? Are ye strong?"
"Thanks to you." How long he would stay strong, Roland didn't know, and right now it wasn't a question that mattered. He saw Jenna snatch up two of the reeds, in his struggle to escape the slings they had scattered all over the head of the bed, and then they were hurrying up the aisle, away from the bugs and from Sister Coquina, whose cries were now failing. Roland buckled on his guns and tied them down without breaking stride. They passed only three beds on each side before reaching the flap of the tent, and it was a tent, he saw, not a vast pavilion. The silk walls and ceiling were fraying canvas, thin enough to let in the light of a three-quarters kissing moon. And the beds weren't beds at all, but only a double row of shabby cots. He turned and saw a black writhing hump on the floor where Sister Coquina had been. At the sight of her, Roland was struck by an unpleasant thought. I forgot John Norman's medallion. A keen sense of regret, almost of mourning, went through him like wind. Jenna reached into the pocket of her jeans and brought it out. It glimmered in the moonlight.
I picked it up off the floor.
He didn't know which made him gladder, the sight of the medallion or the sight of it in her hand. It meant she wasn't like the others. Then, as if to dispel that notion before it got too firm a hold on him, she said,
Take it, Roland. I can hold it no more.
And as he took it, he saw unmistakable marks of charring on her fingers. He took her hand and kissed each burn.
Thank ye, Si, she said, and he saw she was crying. Thank ye, dear. To be kissed so is lovely, worth every pain. Now.
Roland saw her eyes shift and followed them. Here were bobbing lights descending a rocky path. Beyond them he saw the building where the little sisters had been living. Not a convent, but a ruined hacienda that looked 1,000 years old. There were 3 candles. As they drew closer, Roland saw that there were only 3 sisters. Mary wasn't among them. He drew his guns.
Ooh, it's a gunslinger man, he is.
Louise.
A scary man,
Michella.
And he's found his lady love as well as his shooters.
Tamra.
His slut whore.
Louise, laughing angrily. Not afraid. At least, not of his weapons.
Put them away,
Jenna told him, and when she looked saw that he already had. The others, meanwhile, had drawn closer.
Ooh, see, she cries.
Tamra.
Doffed her habit she has,
Michella.
Perhaps it's her broken vows she cries for. Why such tears, pretty?
Louise.
Because he kissed my fingers where they were burned,
Jenna said.
I've never been kissed before. It made me cry.
Ooh! Lovely! Next he'll stick his thing in her, even lovelier.
Jenna bore their japes with no sign of anger. When they were done, she said,
I'm going with him. Stand aside.
They gaped at her, counterfeit laughter disappearing in shock.
No, Louise whispered. Are ye mad? Ye know what'll happen.
No, and neither do you, Jenna said. Besides, I care not.
She half turned and held out her hand to the mouth of the ancient hospital tent. It was a faded olive drab in the moonlight, with an old red cross drawn on its roof. Roland wondered how many towns the sisters had been to with this tent, which was so small and plain on the outside, so huge and gloriously dim on the inside. How many towns, and over how many years? Now cramming the mouth of it in a black, shiny tongue with a doctor bugs. They had stopped their singing. Their silence was terrible.
Stand aside or I'll have them on ye, Jenna said.
Ye never would,
Sister Michella cried in a low, horrified voice.
Aye, I've already set them on Sister Coquina. She's a part of their medicine now.
Their gasp was like cold wind passing through dead trees. Nor was all of that dismay directed toward their own precious hides. What Jenna had done was clearly far outside their reckoning.
Then you're damned,
Sister Tamra said.
Such ones to speak of damnation. Stand aside.
They did. Roland walked past them, and they shrank away from him. But they shrank from her more. Damned? He asked after they had skirted the hacienda and reached the path beyond it. The kissing moon glimmered above a tumbled scree of rocks. In its light, Roland could see a small black opening low on the scarp. He guessed it was the cave the sisters called Thoughtful House. What did they mean, damned?
Never mind. All we have to worry about now is Sister Mary. I like it not that we haven't seen her. She tried to walk faster, but he grasped her arm and turned her about. He could still hear the singing of the bugs, but faintly. They were leaving the place of the sisters behind. Aluria, too, if the compass in his head was still working. He thought the town was in the other direction. The husk of the town, he amended. Tell me what they meant.
Perhaps nothing. Ask me not, Roland. What good is it? 'Tis done. The bridge burned. I can't go back. Nor would if I could.
She looked down, biting her lip, and when she looked up again, Roland saw fresh tears falling on her cheeks.
I have supped with them. There were times when I couldn't help it, no more than you could help drinking their wretched soup, no matter if you knew what was in it.
Roland remembered John Norman saying,
A man has to eat. A woman, too.
He nodded.
I'd go no farther down that road. If there's to be damnation, let it be of my choosing, not theirs. My mother meant well by bringing me back to them, but she was wrong.
She looked at him shyly and fearfully, but met his eyes.
I'd go beside ye on your road, Roland of Gilead, for long as I may or as long as ye'd have me.
You're welcome to your share of my way, he said. And I am blessed by your company, he would have finished. But before he could, a voice spoke from the tangle of moonshadow ahead of them, where the path at last climbed out of the rocky, sterile valley in which the little sisters had practiced their glamours.
It's a sad duty to stop such a pretty elopement, but stop it I must.
Sister Mary came from the shadows. Her fine white habit with its bright red rose had reverted to what it really was, the shroud of a corpse. Caught, hooded in its grimy folds, was a wrinkled, sagging face from which two black eyes stared. They looked like rotted dates. Below them, exposed by the thing's smile, four great incisors gleamed. Upon the stretched skin of Sister Mary's forehead, bells tinkled. But not the dark bells, Roland thought. There was that.
Stand clear, Jenna said, or I'll bring the cantam on ye.
No, Sister Mary said, stepping closer. Ye won't. They'll not stray so far from the others. Shake your head and ring those damned bells until the clappers fall out, and still they'll never come.
Jenna did as bid, shaking her head furiously from side to side. The dark bells rang piercingly, but without that extra, almost psychic tone quality that had gone through Roland's head like a spike. And the doctor bugs, what Jenna had called the cantam, did not come. Smiling ever more broadly, Roland had an idea Mary herself hadn't been completely sure they wouldn't come until the experiment was made. The corpse woman closed in on them, seeming to float above the ground. Her eyes flicked toward him.
"And put that away," she said.
Roland looked down and saw that one of his guns was in his hand. He had no memory of drawing it.
"Unless 'tis blessed or dipped in some sect's holy wet blood, water, semen, it can't harm such as me, gunslinger, for I am more shade than substance, yet still the equal to such as yourself for all that."
She thought he would try shooting her anyway. He saw it in her eyes.
Those shooters are all ye have, her eyes said. Without 'em, you might as well be back in the tent we dreamed around ye, caught up in our slings and awaiting our pleasure.
Instead of shooting, he dropped the revolver back into its holster and launched himself at her with his hands out. Sister Mary uttered a scream that was mostly surprise, but it was not a long one. Roland's fingers clamped down on her throat and choked the sound off before it was fairly started.
The touch of her flesh was obscene. It seemed not just alive, but various beneath his hands, as if it was trying to crawl away from him. He could feel it running like liquid, flowing, and the sensation was horrible beyond description. Yet he clamped down harder, determined to choke the life out of her.
Then there came a blue flash, not in the air, he would think later. That flash happened inside his head, a single stroke of lightning as she touched off some brief but powerful brainstorm, and his hands flew away from her neck. For one moment his dazzled eyes saw great wet gouges in her gray flesh, gouges in the shapes of his hands. Then he was flung backward, hitting the scree on his back and sliding, hitting his head on a jutting rock hard enough to provoke a second lesser flash of light.
"Nay, my pretty man,"
she said, grimacing at him, laughing with those terrible dull eyes of hers.
"Ye don't choke such as me, and I'll take ye slow for impertinence, cut ye shallow in 100 places to refresh my thirst. First, though, I'll have this vowless girl, and I'll have those damned bells off her in the bargain."
"Come and see if you can," Jenna cried in a trembling voice, and shook her head from side to side. The dark bells rang mockingly, provokingly. Mary's grimace of a smile fell away.
"Oh, I can," she breathed.
Her mouth yawned. In the moonlight, her fangs gleamed in her gums like bone needles poked through a red pillow.
"I can, and I..."
There was a growl from above them. It rose, then splintered into a volley of snarling barks. Mary turned to her left, and in the moment before the snarling thing left the rock on which it was standing, Roland could clearly read the startled bewilderment on Big Sister's face. It launched itself at her, only a dark shape against the stars, legs outstretched so it looked like some sort of weird bat. But even before it crashed into the woman, striking her in the chest above her half-raised arms and fastening its own teeth on her throat, Roland knew exactly what it was. As the shape bore her over onto her back, Sister Mary uttered a gibbering shriek that went through Roland's head like the dark bells themselves. He scrambled to his feet, gasping. The shadowy thing tore at her, forepaws on either side of her head, rear paws planted on the grave shroud above her chest where the rose had been. Roland grabbed Jenna, who was looking down at the fallen sister with a kind of frozen fascination. "Come on," he shouted, "before it decides it wants a bite out of you, too." The dog took no notice of them as Roland pulled Jenna past. It had torn Sister Mary's head mostly off. Her flesh seemed to be changing somehow, decomposing very likely, but whatever was happening, Roland did not want to see it. He didn't want Jenna to see it either. They half-walked, half-ran to the top of the ridge, and when they got there, paused for breath in the moonlight, heads down, hands linked, both of them gasping harshly. The growling and snarling below them had faded, but was still faintly audible when Sister Jenna raised her head and asked him,
"What was it? You know I saw it in your face. And how could it attack her? We all have power over animals, but she has had the most."
"Not over that one." Roland found himself recalling the unfortunate boy in the next bed. Norman hadn't known why the medallions kept the sisters at arm length, whether it was the gold or the god. Now Roland knew the answer.
"It was a dog, just a town dog. I saw it in the square before the green folk knocked me out and took me to the sisters. I suppose the other animals that could run away did run away, but not that one. It had nothing to fear from the little sisters of Illyria, and somehow it knew it didn't. It bears the sign of the Jesus man on its chest, black fur on white. Just an accident of its birth, I imagine. In any case, it's done for her now. I knew it was lurking around. I heard it barking 2 or 3 times.
"Why?" Jenna whispered. "Why would it come? Why would it stay? And why would it take on her as it did?"
Roland of Gilead responded as he ever had and ever would when such useless, mystifying questions were raised.
"Ka. Come on, let's get as far as we can from this place before we hide up for the day."
As far as they could turned out to be 8 miles at most, and probably, Roland thought as the two of them sank down in a patch of sweet-smelling sage beneath an overhang of rock, a good deal less,
5, perhaps. It was him slowing them down, or rather it was the residue of the poison in the soup. When it was clear to him that he could not go farther without help, he asked her for one of the reeds. She refused, saying that the stuff in it might combine with the unaccustomed exercise to burst his heart. "Besides," she said as they lay back against the embankment of the little nook they had found, "they'll not follow. Those that are left, Michela, Louise, Tamra, will be packing up to move on. They know to leave when the time comes. That's why the sisters have survived as long as they have. As we have. We are strong in some ways, but weak in many more. Sister Mary forgot that. It was her arrogance that did for her as much as the cross dog, I think." She had cached not just his boots and clothes beyond the top of the ridge, but the smaller of his two purses as well. When she began to apologize for not bringing his bedroll in the larger purse, she tried, she'd said, but they were simply too heavy, Roland hushed her with a finger to her lips. He thought it a miracle to have as much as he did. And besides, this he did not say, but perhaps she knew it anyway, the guns were the only things that really mattered. The guns of his father and his father before him, all the way back to the days of Arthur Eld, when dreams and dragons had still walked the earth. "Will you be all right?" he asked her as they settled down. The moon had set, but dawn was still at least 3 hours away. They were surrounded by the sweet smell of the sage, a purple smell, he thought it then, and ever after. Already he could feel it forming a kind of magic carpet under him, which would soon float him away to sleep. He thought he had never been so tired. "Roland, I know not." But even then he thought she had known. Her mother had brought her back once. No mother would bring her back again. And she had eaten with the others, had taken the communion of the sisters. Ka was a wheel. It was also a net from which none ever escaped. But then he was too tired to think much of such things. And what good would thinking have done in any case? As she said, the bridge was burned. Roland guessed that even if they were to return to the valley, they would find nothing but the cave the sisters had called the Thoughtful House. The surviving sisters would have packed their tent of bad dreams and moved on, just a sound of bells and singing insects moving down the late-night breeze. He looked at her, raised a hand, it felt heavy, and touched the curl which once more lay across her forehead. Jenna laughed, embarrassed. "That one always escapes. It's wayward, like its mistress." She raised her hand to poke it back in, but Roland took her fingers before she could. "It's beautiful," he said. "Black as night and as beautiful as forever." He sat up. It took an effort. Weariness dragged at his body like soft hands. He kissed the curl. She closed her eyes and sighed. He felt her trembling beneath his lips. The skin of her brow was very cool, the dark curve of the wayward curl like silk. "Push back your wimple as you did before," he said. She did it without speaking. For a moment he only looked at her. Jenna looked back gravely, her eyes never leaving his. He ran his hands through her hair, feeling its smooth weight. Like rain, he thought, rain with weight. Then took her shoulders and kissed each of her cheeks. He drew back for a moment. "Would ye kiss me as a man does a woman, Roland? On my mouth?" "Aye." And as he had thought of doing as he lay caught in the silken infirmary tent, he kissed her lips. She kissed back with the clumsy sweetness of one who has never kissed before, except perhaps in dreams. Roland thought to make love to her then. It had been long and long, and she was beautiful. But he fell asleep instead, still kissing her. He dreamed of the cross dog barking its way across a great open landscape. He followed, wanting to see the source of its agitation, and soon he did.
At the far edge of that plain stood the Dark Tower, its smoky stone outlined by the dull orange ball of a setting sun, its fearful windows rising in a spiral. The dog stopped at the sight of it and began to howl. Bells, peculiarly shrill and as terrible as doom, began to ring. Dark bells, he knew, but their tone was as bright as silver. At their sound, the dark windows of the tower glowed with the deadly red light, the red of poisoned roses. A scream of unbearable pain rose in the night. The dream blew away in an instant, but the scream remained, now unraveling to a moan. That part was real as the tower brooding in its place at the very end of Endworld. Roland came back to the brightness of dawn and the soft purple smell of desert sage. He had drawn both his guns and was on his feet before he had fully realized he was awake. Jenna was gone. Her boots lay empty beside his purse. A little distance from them, her jeans lay as flat as discarded snake skins. Above them was her shirt. It was, Roland observed with wonder, still tucked into the pants. Beyond them was her empty wimple, with its fringe of bells lying on the powdery ground. He thought for a moment that they were ringing, mistaking the sound he heard at first. Not bells, but bugs. The doctor bugs. They sang in the sage, sounding a bit like crickets, but far sweeter. Jenna? No answer, unless the bugs answered, for their singing suddenly stopped. Jenna? Nothing. Only the wind and the smell of the sage. Without thinking about what he was doing, like play-acting, reasoned thought was not his strong suit. He bent, picked up the wimple, and shook it. The dark bells rang. For a moment there was nothing. Then a thousand small dark creatures came scurrying out of the sage, gathering on the broken earth. Roland thought of the battalion marching down the side of the freighter's bed and took a step back. Then he held his position. As he saw, the bugs were holding theirs. He believed he understood. Some of this understanding came from his memory of how Sister Mary's flesh had felt under his hands, how it had felt various, not one thing, but many. Part of it was what she had said. I have supped with them. Such as them might never die, but they might change. The insects trembled, a dark cloud of them blotting out the white, powdery earth. Roland shook the bells again. A shiver ran through them in a subtle wave, and then they began to form a shape. They hesitated, as if unsure of how to go on, regrouped, began again. What they eventually made on the whiteness of the sand there between the blowing fluffs of lilac-colored sage was one of the great letters, the letter C. Except it wasn't really a letter, the gunslinger saw. It was a curl. They began to sing, and to Roland it sounded as if they were singing his name. The bells fell from his unnerved hand, and when they struck the ground and chimed there, the mass of bugs broke apart, running in every direction. He thought of calling them back. Ringing the bells again might do that. But to what purpose? To what end? Ask me not, Roland. 'Tis done. The bridge burned. Yet she had come to him one last time, imposing her will over a thousand various parts that should have lost the ability to think when the whole lost its cohesion. And yet she had thought somehow, enough to make that shape. How much effort might that have taken? They fanned wider and wider, some disappearing into the sage, some trundling up the sides of a rock overhang, pouring into the cracks where they would, mayhap, wait out the heat of the day. They were gone. She was gone. Roland sat down on the ground and put his hands over his face. He thought he might weep, but in time the urge passed.
When he raised his head again, his eyes were as dry as the desert he would eventually come to, still following the trail of Walter, the man in black.
"If there's to be damnation," she had said, "let it be of my choosing, not theirs."
He knew a little about damnation himself, and he had an idea that the lessons, far from being done, were just beginning. She had brought him the purse with his tobacco in it. He rolled a cigarette and smoked it, hunkered over his knees. He smoked it down to a glowing roach, looking at her empty clothes the while, remembering the steady gaze of her dark eyes, remembering the scorch marks on her fingers from the chain of the medallion. Yet she had picked it up, because she had known he would want it, had dared that pain, and Roland now wore both around his neck. When the sun was fully up, the gunslinger moved on west. He would find another horse eventually, or a mule, but for now he was content to walk. All that day he was haunted by a ringing, singing sound in his ears, a sound like bells. Several times he stopped and looked around, sure he would see a dark following shape flowing over the ground, chasing after as the shadows of our best and worst memories chase after. But no shape was ever there. He was alone in the low hill country west of Aluria. Quite alone.
Everything's Eventual. Read by Justin Long.
One. I've got a good job now and no reason to feel glum. No more hanging out with the Gumby heads at the Super Saver policing up the cart corral and getting bothered by assholes like Skipper. Skipper's munching the old dirt sandwich these days, but one thing I have learned in my 19 years on this planet Earth is don't relax. There are Skippers everywhere. Ditto no more pulling pizza patrol on rainy nights, driving my old Ford with a bad muffler, freezing my ass off with the driver's side window down, and a little Italian flag sticking out on a wire, like somebody in Harkerville was going to salute. Pizza aroma. Quarter tips from people who don't even see you because most of their mind's still on the TV football game. Driving for Pizza Roma was the lowest point, I think. Since then I've even had a ride in a private jet, so how could things be bad? This is what comes of leaving school without a diploma, Ma would say during my delivery Dan stint. And you've got this to look forward to for the rest of your life. Good old Ma. On and on until I actually thought about writing her one of those special letters. As I say, that was the low point. You know what Mr. Sharpton told me that night in his car? It's not just a job, Dink. It's a goddamn adventure. And he was right. Whatever he might have been wrong about, he was right about that. I suppose you're wondering about the salary of this famous job. Well, I gotta tell you, there's not much money in it. Might as well get that right up front. But a job isn't just about money or getting ahead. That's what Mr. Sharpton told me. Mr. Sharpton said that a real job is about the fringe benefits. He said that's where the power is. Mr. Sharpton. I only saw him that once, sitting behind the wheel of his big old Mercedes-Benz, but sometimes once is enough. Take that any way you want. Any old way at all. 2. I've got a house, okay? My very own house. That's fringe benefit number 1. I call Ma sometimes, ask her how her bad leg is, shoot the shit. But I've never invited her over here, although Harkerville's only 70 or so miles away, and I know she's practically busting a gut with curiosity. I don't even have to go see her unless I want to. Mostly I don't want to. If you knew my mother, you wouldn't want to either. Sit there in that living room with her while she talks about all her relatives and whines about her puffy leg. Also, I never noticed how much the house smelled of cat shit until I got out of it. I'm never going to have a pet. Pets bite the big one. Mostly I just stay here. It's only got 1 bedroom, but it's still an excellent house. Eventual, as Pug used to say. He was the one guy at the Super Saver I liked. When he wanted to say something was really good, Pug would never say it was awesome like most people do. He'd say it was eventual. How funny is that? The old Pugmeister. I wonder how he's doing. Okay, I suppose. But I can't call him and make sure. I can call my Ma and I have an emergency number if anything ever goes wrong, or if I think somebody's getting nosy about what's not their business. But I can't buzz any of my old friends, as if any of them besides Pug gave shit one about Dinky Earnshaw. Mr. Sharpton's rules. But never mind that. Let's go back to my house here in Columbia City. How many 19-year-old high school dropouts do you know who have their own houses? Plus a new car? Only a Honda, true, but the first 3 numbers on the odometer are still zeros, and that's the important part. It has a CD tape player, and I don't slide in behind the wheel wondering if the goddamn thing will start, like I always did with the Ford, which Skipper used to make fun of. The asshole mobile, he'd call it. Why are there so many Skippers in the world? That's what I really wonder about. I do get some money, by the way, more than enough to meet my needs. Check this out. I watch As the World Turns every day while I'm eating my lunch, and on Thursdays, about halfway through the show, I hear the clack of the mail slot. I don't do anything then. I'm not supposed to. Like Mr. Sharpton said, them's the rules, Dink. I just watch the rest of my show. The exciting stuff on the soaps always happens around the weekends. Murders on Fridays, fucking on Mondays. But I watch right to the end every day just the same. I'm especially careful to stay in the living room until the end on Thursdays. On Thursdays, I don't even go out to the kitchen for another glass of milk. When World is over, I turn off the TV for a while. Oprah Winfrey comes on next. I hate her show. All that sitting around talking shit is for the Mas of the world. And go out to the front hall. Lying on the floor under the mail slot, there's always a plain white envelope sealed. Nothing written on the front. Inside there'll be either 14 $5 bills or 7 $10 bills. That's my money for the week. Here's what I do with it. I go to the movies twice, always in the afternoon, when it's just $4.50. That's $9. On Saturday, I fill up my Honda with gas, and that's usually about $7. I don't drive much. I'm not invested in it, as Pug would say. So now we're up to $16. I'll eat out maybe 4 times at Mickey D's, either at breakfast, Egg McMuffin, coffee, 2 hash browns, or at dinner, quarter pounder with cheese, never mind that mixed special shit, what dimbulb thought those up. Once a week, I put on chinos and a button-up shirt, and I see how the other half lives. Have a fancy meal at a place like Adam's Ribs or the Chuck Wagon. All of that goes me about $25, and now we're up to $41. Then I might go buy News Plus and buy a stroke book or two. Nothing really kinky, just your usual, like, Variations or Penthouse. I have tried writing these mags down on Dinky's Dayboard, but with no success. I can buy them myself, and they don't disappear on cleaning day or anything. But they don't show up, if you see what I'm getting at, like most other stuff does. I guess Mr. Sharpton's cleaners don't like to buy dirty stuff. Pun. Also, I can't get to any of the sex stuff on the internet. I have tried, but it's blocked out somehow. Usually things like that are easy to deal with. You go under or around the roadblocks if you can't hack straight through, but this is different. Not to belabor the point, but I can't dial 900 numbers on the phone either. The auto dialer works, of course, and if I want to call somebody just at random, anywhere in the world, and shoot the shit with them for a while, that's okay. That works. But the 900 numbers don't. You just get a busy. Probably just as well. In my experience, thinking about sex is like scratching poison ivy. You only spread it around. Besides, sex is no big deal, at least for me. It's there, but it isn't eventual. Still, considering what I'm doing, that little prudy streak is sort of weird. Almost funny. Except I seem to have lost my sense of humor on the subject. A few others as well. Oh well, back to the budget. If I get a variations, that's $4 and we're up to $45. Some of the money that's left I might use to buy a CD, although I don't have to, or a candy bar or two. I know I shouldn't because my complexion still blows dead rats, although I'm almost not a teenager anymore. I think of calling out for a pizza or for Chinese sometimes, but it's against TransCorp's rules. Also, I would feel weird doing it, like a member of the oppressing class. I have delivered pizza, remember? I know what a sucky job it is. Still, if I could order in, the pizza guy wouldn't leave this house with a quarter tip. I'd lay $5 on him, watch his eyes light up. But you're starting to see what I mean about not needing a lot of cash, aren't you? When Thursday morning rolls around again, I usually have at least $8 left, and sometimes it's more like 20. What I do with the coins is drop them down the storm drain in front of my house. I am aware that this would freak the neighbors out if they saw me doing it. I'm a high school dropout, but I didn't leave because I was stupid, thank you very much. So I take out the blue plastic recycling basket with the newspapers in it, and sometimes with a penthouse or variations buried halfway down the stack. I don't keep that shit around for long. Who would? And while I'm putting it down on the curb, I open the hand with the change in it, and through the grate in the gutter it goes. Tinkle, 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 splash, like a magician's trick. Now you see it, now you don't. Someday that drain will get clogged up, they'll send a guy down there and he'll think he won the fucking lottery. Unless there's a flood or something that pushes all the change down to the waste treatment plant or wherever it goes. By then I'll be gone. I'm not going to spend my life in Columbia City, I can tell you that. I'm leaving, and soon, one way or the other. The currency is easier. I just poke it down the garbage disposal in the kitchen. Another magic trick. Presto, change-o, money into lettuce. You probably think that's very weird, running money through the sink pig. I did too, at first. But you get used to just about anything after you do it for a while. And besides, there's always another 70 falling through the letter slot. The rule is simple. No squirreling it away. End the week broke. Besides, it's not millions we're talking about, only $8 or $10 a week. Chump change, really. 3. Dinky's Day Board. That's another fringe benefit. I write down whatever I want during the week, and I get everything I ask for, except sex mags, as I told you. Maybe I'll get bored with that eventually, but right now it's like having Santa Claus all year round. Mostly what I write down is groceries, like anyone does on their kitchen chalkboard, but by no means is groceries all. I might, for instance, write down new Bruce Willis video, or new Weezer CD, or something like that. A funny thing about that Weezer CD, since we're on the subject, I happened to go into Tunes Express one Friday after my movie was over. I always go to the show on Friday afternoons, even if there's nothing I really want to see, because that's when the cleaners come. Just killing time inside because it was rainy and that squashed going to the park. And while I was looking at the new releases, this kid asks a clerk about the new Weezer CD. The clerk tells him it won't be in for another 10 days or so, but I'd had it since the Friday before. Fringe benefits, like I say. If I write down sports shirt on the day board, there it is when I get back to the house on Friday night, always in one of the nice earth tone colors I like. If I write down new jeans or chinos, I get those. All stuff from the Gap, which is where I'd go myself if I had to do stuff like that. If I want a certain kind of aftershave lotion or cologne, I write the name on Dinky's dayboard, and it's on the bathroom counter when I get home. I don't date, but I'm a fool for cologne. Go figure. Here's something you'll laugh at, I bet. Once I wrote down Rembrandt painting on the dayboard, then I spent the afternoon at the movies and walking in the park, watching people making out and dogs catching frisbees, thinking how eventual it would be if the cleaners actually brought me my own fucking Rembrandt. Think of it. A genuine old master on the wall of a house in the Sunset Knoll section of Columbia City. How eventual would that be? And it happened, in a manner of speaking. My Rembrandt was hung on the living room wall when I got home, over the sofa where the velvet clowns used to be. My heart was beating about 200 a minute as I walked across the room toward it. When I got closer, I saw it was just a copy, you know, a reproduction. I was disappointed, but not very. I mean, it was a Rembrandt, just not an original Rembrandt. Another time I wrote autographed photo of Nicole Kidman on the dayboard. I think she's the best-looking actress alive. She just gets me on so much. And when I got home that day, there was a publicity still of her on the fridge, held there by a couple of those little vegetable magnets. She was on her Moulin Rouge swing. And that time it was the real deal. I know because of the way it was signed. To Dinky Earnshaw, with love and kisses from Nicole. Oh, baby. Oh, honey. Tell you something, my friend. If I worked hard and really wanted it, there might be a real Rembrandt on my wall someday. Sure. In a job like this, there is nowhere to go but up. In a way, that's the scary part. 4. I never have to make grocery lists. The cleaners know what I like. Stouffer's frozen dinners, especially that boil-in-the-bag stuff they call cream chip beef, and Ma had always called shit on a shingle. Frozen strawberries, whole milk, preformed hamburger patties that you just have to slap in a hot frying pan. I hate playing with raw meat. Dole puddings, the ones that come in plastic cups. Bad for my complexion, but I love them. Ordinary food like that. If I want something special, I write it down on Dinky's dayboard. Once I asked for a homemade apple pie, specifically not from the supermarket. And when I came back that night around the time it was getting dark, my pie was in the fridge with the rest of the week's groceries. Only it wasn't wrapped up, it was just sitting there on a blue plate. That's how I knew it was homemade. I was a little hesitant about eating it at first, not knowing where it came from and all. And then I decided I was being stupid. A person doesn't really know where supermarket food comes from. Not really. I mean, we assume it's okay because it's wrapped up or in a can or double-sealed for your protection, but anyone could have been handling it with dirty fingers before it was double-sealed or sneezing great big whoops of booger breath on it or even wiping their asses with it. I don't mean to gross you out, but it's true, isn't it? The world is full of strangers and a lot of them are up to no good. I have had personal experience of this, believe me. Anyway, I tried the pie and it was delicious. I ate half of it Friday night and the rest on Saturday morning while I was running the numbers in Cheyenne, Wyoming. Most of Saturday night I spent on the toilet, shitting my guts out from all those apples, I guess, but I didn't care. The pie was worth it. Like my mother used to make, is what people say, but it can't be my mother they say it about. My ma couldn't fry Spam. 5. I never have to write down underwear on the dayboard. Every 5 weeks or so, the old drawers disappear, and there are brand new Hanes jockey shorts in my bureau. 4 3-packs still in their plastic bags. Double sealed for my protection. Toilet paper, laundry soap, dishwasher soap. I never have to write any of that shit down. It just appears. Very eventual, don't you think? 6. I have never seen the cleaners any more than I have ever seen the guy, or maybe it's a gal, who delivers my $70 every Thursday during As the World Turns. I never want to see them either. I don't need to, for one thing. For another, yes, okay, I'm afraid of them, just like I was afraid of Mr. Sharpton and his big gray Mercedes on the night I went out to meet him. So sue me. I don't eat lunch in my house on Fridays. I watch as the world turns, then jump in my car and drive into town. I get a burger at Mickey D's, then go to a movie, then to the park if the weather is good. I like the park. It's a good place to think, and these days I've got an awful lot to think about. If the weather